Hi, this is Tamsin Granger.
This is Dan Abuhoff.
And we're here with Tamsin and Dan Read the Paper. It's Sunday, August 6th, 2017. Little shout out
to my brother Bob. Bob's birthday, his, I'll say it, 65th birthday, tomorrow, August 7th, 2017. Happy birthday, Bob.
All right, so here we go. This is our re-entry broadcast.
Exactly. We're back.
We're done with vacations.
Back to business. Back this entirely. We're all business this week.
All right.
And we lead with the passing of Sam Shepard. Sam Shepard, very interesting character, a successful playwright and actor, polymath. That's the word they use for folks like that, right? Polymath. And it's he's quite an impressive guy, although the pieces don't quite fit together, which is what makes him interesting. We went to a play of Sam Shepard's. He had many plays that were produced downtown when he was very young. I think the first play he ever had produced on Broadway was the recent production we went to a year ago of Fool for Love with Nina Ariende and Sam Rockwell, which got a good review. And I will tell you, quite frankly, I could not make head nor tails out of that play.
It was pretty forgettable, even though I love Nina Ariende. I was very excited to see her again. Yes.
And she was acting up a storm. I don't know what was going on the stage, but she was acting as was Sam Rockwell, who got very good reviews. But that, I think, is not entirely inconsistent with the with the Sam Shepard retinue of plays. I mean, it's not like he wrote Pygmalion. He wrote about some odd plays that were very inexpensive to produce. It's got some notice, interested some actors, but establishes him as an offbeat downtown character. As a matter of fact, he had a musical bent. He traveled a little with Bob Dylan as a drummer. And he was just this odd, laconic, tall drink of water from the Southwest.
Basically about human relationships, personal relationships,
exactly.
Would you say? Yeah.
Yeah, and he had had a troubled past. His dad was alcoholic, and he was hard to figure. But he was also a striking presence. And as it turned out, one night he was doing a poetry reading. It was attended by a fellow named Phil Kaufman, who was about to direct a movie called The Right Stuff. And he was having trouble casting the part of Chuck Yeager, the famous test pilot, who was considered, the ultimate macho man, the alpha male, if you will, among the various pilots who would vie for the opportunity to be astronauts in the first group of astronauts in the early 60s, a heroic figure. And they're there for the poetry reading for no particular reason, and his wife, Rose, nudges Phil and says, "Phil, that's your guy." He says, "What are you talking about?" He says, "That's Chuck Yeager." And he was. And
which is just funny.
It is funny.
Because Shepard is afraid of flying.
He's afraid of flying.
He's gotten better at it, apparently. But
Right.
He went up in a plane with Yeager.
Yeah, well, here's the interesting thing about this story. So, Sam Shepard's an artiste, right? They approached Sam Shepard. He said, "We want you to be in this movie to play Chuck Yeager." He goes, "What?" And he says, "Well, I don't know, but isn't it kind of dumb to play a guy who's still alive? That seems kind of silly." And they say, no, it'll be good, it'll be good. And so they actually, in the meantime, Phil Kaufman's in a big dispute with the studio as to whether there's going to be a Chuck Yeager character, because the movies based on Thomas Wolfe's book about these astronauts, and it's largely about them. And yet there was the figure of Sam Shepard, Chuck Yeager, the great test pilot, who did not go up in space, who was in the book. And Phil Kaufman was arguing with the folks making the movie about whether that should be a major figure in the play. In the movie. And he eventually won that argument. And the way he convinced Shepard to do it was they brought Chuck Yeager on the set. And Chuck Yeager played a bartender. And Sam Shepard bonded. It turns out they were the two alpha males on the set. And they hung out together all the time. And as Tam said just a moment ago, Sam Shepard was afraid of flying. And he would only fly with Chuck Yeager. And his explanation was, if I'm going to go down in a plane with the best pilot in America, I guess that's okay. So he flew with Yeager, he drank with Yeager, and there were a lot of other young guys who were very athletic and played the astronauts on the set, folks like Ed Harris and Dennis Quaid and Fred Ward and Scott Glenn. And these two guys were the alpha males in the group.
What I heard Shepard say in an interview about Yeager was that Yeager said to him, look, it's not about not being afraid.
Yeah.
Okay. It's about facing your fears.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, look.
Because Yeager did seem fearless, well, right? But well, that wasn't the deal.
Well, look, the movie, you know, it's something, the more I'm remembering the movie and reading about the movie in the wake of Shepard's passing, it was a very interesting movie. And I read now that it wasn't a terribly successful movie. And the reason is because while it was originally thought of being a celebration of the original seven astronauts, and you remember Life magazine celebrating We Seven.
Sure, yeah.
What they picked up on in the movie was the Thomas Wolfe theme was that it was a big publicity rush. It was all about Life magazine. It was all about promoting that program. Lyndon Johnson's quote as vice president was, I will not live under a communist moon. And and on top of that, in terms of having the press all over the astronauts, they always said, no Bucks, no Buck Rogers. So these guys were brought in, these test pilots, like John Glenn and others, were brought in to help promote. Well, that's all fine, and some of them were heroic and worthy and so on, including Glenn. But Sam Shepard's character, Chuck Yeager, existed outside of that. And he was the great outsider, the loner, the genuine article. And he was the counterpoint to these publicity-hounded astronauts whose big conflict in the movie was whether there was going to be a window in the spacecraft so they could have some kind of active role in participating. At the same time, the character Chuck Yeager was making all these very dangerous flights in which he was, of course, piloting the aircraft in very dangerous space. And that counterpoint made an interesting movie, but cost the movie at the box office, they said, because America, believe it or not, even at that time, wasn't ready for a story that was somewhat ambivalent about the space program.
Too many layers.
Too many layers. Well, they're ambivalent about the space program. Who were the heroes? Yeah. And the heroes was really Chuck Yeager / Sam Shepard. And it was kind of, it's interesting. The last few minutes of the movie, I was reminded in reading about it, the very last minute of the movie, Dennis Quaid's character is up in the aircraft. And he looks out the window, and he's actually seeing space. And he says, Lord, what a heavenly light. And that reflected the resolution of the window controversy, which was something, but not great big deal. The scene just before that was the iconic scene that many people remember from the movie, in which Chuck Yeager is out there with no publicity, trying to break some speed record in some supersonic airplane, and it crashes. And there's a fireball. And all you see for a moment from the distance is this fire and this smoke, and then you see this figure emerging by himself.
Yeah.
And at the same, meanwhile, a fair piece away, an ambulance pulls up, and there's a police officer there. And the ambulance driver jumps out and addresses the police officer and says, sir, over there, is that a man? Yeah, the officer replies, you're damn right it is.
Nice.
So that's Sam Shepard as Chuck Yeager.
Okay, so in the New York Times, they had their, you know, one of their special education sections. And one of the big stories is why kids can't write.
Right.
And of course, I take exception with this.
Right.
Because actually, I think kids can write. Mm-hmm. But we'll talk about that more. And it basically points out that students are doing less and less well on various standardized writing tests, etc. And they divide this sort of discussion, how to improve kids' writing, into kind of two camps. And one of them, it takes place in Nassau County Community College. Mm-hmm. Okay, so there's a group of young women trying to learn how to write better, mm-hmm. Actually for their college entrance exams.
Right.
Their college admissions essays. And in fact, the student they really center on is a rising senior at Westbury High School.
Close to where I grew up.
Right. And but not as good as Jericho High.
No, sorry.
No, never. And she's considering applying to NYU, Columbia, Stony Brook. So I would say, really? Are these the kids we're worried about? Okay.
Right.
Just trying to finesse their writing a little bit so that they can get in to NYU.
And they're not.
That doesn't seem like an emergency to me.
Right.
And And the quotations they give of poor writing are much more primitive to that.
Right, and which is the kind of thing that you and I were talking before, which you see in your own classes, teaching community college, in terms of kids whose writing is much more limited.
Right, and so the discussion is, between how do you teach students to write better?
Right.
And do you do that by this creative free writing process, mm-hmm. where you bring them in touch with, their inner selves, right. more creative content?
See, and the audience is missing the gesticulating here.
Once you free all that, the words will flow.
Yeah. Okay.
And then there's the other side of the coin that this writer addresses, Dana Goldstein, and. She says, well, then there is the school of thought that what you need is good grammar. These students need to go back to diagramming sentences, yeah, right. and understanding how punctuation works.
The way you put them both,
works.
You don't seem to believe in either one of them. That's the thing.
Well, here's the deal. Yeah. Here's the deal. As I said, first of all, kids are writing more than ever.
Right.
Granted, it's on a phone.
Right.
Okay. And apparently part of the problem is when they don't have the phone and the spell check and the autofill and so on, right. that if they're on a computer or with a piece of paper, they don't, they can't write as well.
Right.
Okay. There's a couple of issues here. One is the article says teachers don't know how to teach writing.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I don't know if that's really the problem. Teachers are beleaguered to actually give writing assignments, grade them, etc. is a lot of work. So, and a lot of time.
Mm-hmm.
So I have a feeling that's more the problem. Time and effort is the issue as opposed to ability to teach writing.
Mm-hmm.
Number two, I think students are writing the way they hear.
Right.
Okay. If you grow up in a very sort of limited circumstances, yeah. and people talk a certain way, you probably write that way.
Right.
That's not the language your teacher wants to hear.
Right.
Okay. Verbs may not agree with subjects, etc., but that's your understanding of
how
language works.
How do you get past that?
I would say, in my mind, you have to change the way they hear. You have to encourage articulation. You have to encourage discussion in class,
mm-hmm.
that teaches them a different way of talking. It's like teaching a language. It's like teaching Spanish or French, okay? You have to practice. You have to engage. You have to build in them a desire to write in that language.
So you're talking about actively engaging them verbally, and you're saying that will work.
I think that will help. I think you can teach boring old grammar and punctuation till you're blue in the face. If that doesn't resonate with the students, they're not going to use it.
Well, I'm hearing two things. Number one, you're saying you don't believe it's a matter of diagramming sentences, which I willingly believe, because even now I probably couldn't do that. But you're saying that the teacher's role is very much active engagement. In a way, and this takes you to another debate, as to whether you can learn everything on the internet, and you obviously can't. That the thing that pulls these kids, or potentially pulls these kids, into a different level of dialogue, and ultimately a different level of self-expression in writing, is being brought there by the teacher.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, I can believe that.
So.
And I can believe it's a lot of work, too.
Yeah.
Yeah. But, all right. Well, that's a challenge. I mean, and it is a challenge. There's no question. All right. So, one other very notable passing this week, in a different area, Ara Parseghian, although it does take us to the question of manliness again, strangely. Ara Parseghian was the great football coach of Notre Dame for a number of years, and Notre Dame having that great football program. He started in around 1964 and stayed for about 20 years or so. And there's no denying his success, but he is remembered even now for an extremely controversial decision he made in a very controversial football game. If you can believe it, it's still a live controversy some 50, 60 years after
with
the fact.
With football guys. I gotta say, I recognize the name Ara Parseghian right away. And the story you're about to tell
we'll see. Well, you recognize him also because he became a football commentator after he left Notre Dame for 20 years. So he's been on television a long time. But in any event, 1966. Let me take you back to 1966 when you were a young girl, very young girl. And
probably not watching Notre Dame football.
Well, no one was. It wasn't on national television.
Really?
No, because the
life was different. So how do you even know about it?
God only knows. Michigan State, Notre Dame, the co-number one teams in the country, both undefeated in November of 1966, playing for the national championship.
Okay.
This doesn't happen very often, and particularly didn't happen then because the bowl games weren't set up as they are now. And this was a game that, you know, was very much focused on the whole football-focused part of the country was you know, very much paying attention to this. The big sporting event of a five-year period, let's say. Pre-Super Bowl, by the way. And
so was Notre Dame a big powerhouse?
Well, they were co-number one that year. It was Michigan State.
But I mean, so it was like a national...
Yeah, national game. I mean, Aaron Prosigan had brought the team back. Notre Dame's fortunes had gone down. Aaron Prosigan had been the coach of Northwestern, and he was brought in to try to change their fortunes, and he had. And he had them on the cusp of a national championship, and they were playing... In Michigan, I'll have to, you know, I'm not sure. I should look that up. I forget who the home team was. But the fact of the matter is...
Where's that producer? Who does this research?
The fact of the matter is, the score was 10-10. It was 10-10 with more than a minute to go in the game. And Michigan State punted, and Notre Dame had the ball at their 30-yard line with a minute and 20 to go. And what did Aaron Prosigan do?
What?
He ran out the clock.
So it ended in a tie?
Right.
And there's no overtime or anything?
No.
Is that okay?
No.
Oh.
That's what happened.
Fans went crazy?
They went crazy. So our only source of sports information at that time was Sports Illustrated. Here's what they wrote. They wrote, "Old Notre Dame will tie overall. Sing it out, guys." That's not exactly what the march says, but that's how the big game ends every time you replay it. For those who saw it, all the game had was this enormous emptiness for which the Irish will be forever blamed. He ran out the clock.
But now, why?
That's a good question. Why? And that's what he was asked after. He said, well, here's the deal. We were tied. And, you know, I was concerned that we would throw an interception or something like that. We were at our own 30. And I didn't want to take a chance. I'd hate to lose a game like that on a play like that. And you're going, what, really? Because more than a minute, he could have had 5, 6, 7 plays. And he didn't try it. And it was so controversial and so heated at the time. If you can put yourself back into that moment and on that field even, you know, and these are star players on both teams. At one point, apparently, Bubba Smith, you remember the name Bubba Smith?
Who became
a big-time football player for the Colts, I think, for many, many years, and then on television, pitchman. 6'8", if I recall correctly, leaned across the line of scrimmage after he saw that Notre Dame was running out the clock and called them sissies. Sissies! Harsh words. And that's the way Michigan State took it. And a lot of criticism was heaped on Notre Dame. Prosigan just said he didn't want to take the chance. Now, he was, in a sense, rewarded. He had one more game to go. Notre Dame played the following week against USC. They beat them handily. Michigan State had no more games. As a result...
They were number one.
They were voted the number one team in the country. Yeah. Neither went to a bowl game. It was different then. Notre Dame didn't go to bowl games. Michigan State was not allowed by the Big Ten to go to two Rose Bowls in a row. That was it. And Notre Dame was voted number one. But in many people's eyes, Prosigan was never forgiven.
So he never lived it down?
He never lived it down. You know, one thing we were talking about before, you know, how do you explain it? Well, he was a young coach. You know, it's funny, he almost didn't get the Notre Dame job. He was there a couple of years. Notre Dame did not want to hire him because he was not Catholic. They offered the job to Dan Devine, the Missouri coach. He turned it down, and Prosigan got it. Maybe he just didn't feel secure about that. I don't know. But people said at the time, you know something? This will be part of Prosigan's epitaph, and it is.
Literally?
Literally.
Really?
Well, no. I don't know. Well, it's not.
Did we go to his tombstone? No, is it written there? No.
Epitaph, I think we decide, is a broader meaning than just tombstone.
But it's, even, but it's largely what's written on your tombstone.
People are talking about it. It's in all the obituaries.
So the tombstone in your head for Eric Orsigian has that epitaph.
Look, it's a funny story. I mean, it's an odd situation.
Okay, you know, it's been a while since we talked about food, really, I think. Have we talked about food very much? And there's an article in the Wall Street Journal that is driving me nuts that's titled, No, Americans Aren't Finally Ready to Cook. And it starts out, it's all about the meal kit craze. Mm-hmm. So, which seems to be cooking, right?
Mm-hmm.
Amazon just is venturing into this, and of course we have Blue Apron. We have all these a zillion different meal kit situations where you can basically order the ingredients for dinner, somewhat prepped, the instructions, put it all together, and have dinner. So, and this article contends that Americans, this appeals to Americans because they don't want to cook. Or only marginally appeals to Americans. And they cite as their source a travel journal from 1794, where the writer says, Americans know the value of time too well to waste it at the table.
Hmm.
And I don't know, it just seems like another one of those rants. And they mentioned that by 2016, the time that women spend cooking has fallen to 37 minutes a day. According to the Bureau of Labor Statistics. Is that necessarily a bad thing?
I don't know. Well, it's a hard number to figure. Because on the average, if you eat out, maybe it means that there's... Who knows? Who knows? But I don't get much from it.
And that most American meals are planned less than an hour before they're eaten. I have no problem with that.
No.
You know, you go to the refrigerator, you see what's there, or you stop by the market on your way home and see what's fresh.
Well, but
it doesn't mean it's...
But here's the question. I mean, are Americans...
Is cooking only good if you labor over it for hours?
Is there anything to the notion...
And chop every little thing.
Is there anything to the notion that Americans are anti-cooking?
Is there any chef who is chopping all his stuff? No.
Is there anything to the notion that Americans are anti-cooking?
No, I don't think it is at all. Because, okay. I mean, they love to watch cooking.
Right.
We know that. The cooking shows are tremendous.
Well, you know something? It's more than the cooking shows. It's all these cooking videos now. And the cooking videos apparently are used by people... to eyeball while they're cooking. I mean, that's what that's all about. So I see it the opposite way.
Mainly, you know, I mean, I think that these meal kits are probably a good gateway
To
absolutely, cooking.
Absolutely.
Okay? Kids don't learn to cook anymore in the house. They can't.
It's shopping they don't want to do.
Well, yeah. And who wants to do that, really? And they cite as things like, you know, the Blue Apron stock prices. Is sliding. Is that because of
because
people or is that because of competition?
It's because Amazon's in that. Right.
Anyway, they say... at the end of the article, it says, Amazon needs to tweak their clever slogan. We do the prep so that you can pretend to be the chef. How snarky is that? So I don't buy that. Don't like that. Not a well-written article. But anyway, so catching up on my reading, I threatened to read this book, What She Ate, by Laura Shapiro. Okay, and I've been under the weather a little bit lately, so I've had lots of time to read, and it was about six women and what they... Not a very good book.
Okay.
Not that well written, very disappointing.
Okay.
But I'll be interested to see if anybody else reads it. On the other hand, when you talk about great cookbooks and great cookbook editors... what comes to mind is perhaps the passing of Judith Jones,
mm-hmm.
who was the person who brought us Julia Child, actually. So we, you know, many of us have heard about that, especially with that movie that came out about Julia and a young woman in Brooklyn cooking Julia's recipes for 365 days and so on, and which really gave a bump to Julia's famous Mastering the Art of French Cooking.
Mm-hmm.
But there are a lot of interesting things about Judith Jones. Number one is that she actually is responsible for encouraging the publishing of the English version of Anne Frank's diary.
Mm-hmm.
She was a lowly member of publishing in... Paris at the time and came across her desk this Anne Frank's diary, Diary of a Young Girl, mm-hmm. that had been published in Europe in various languages. And she was struck by it. She was also the editor for a lot of well-known...
Yeah, no, I noticed this. It's funny because Tams and I sort of pick up articles during the week of interest. And, you know, you read a lot of articles, including a lot of obituaries and things. And we both picked out this person's obituary.
She was the editor for...
She was the editor for John Updike. You know, and it's kind of buried in there. They're talking about it. She was a food editor. But it's kind of hard to imagine this woman is the editor of John Updike. John Updike, you know, I wouldn't say he's macho, but his books are, let's say, focused heavily on sex from the male perspective. Not, I would think, having a huge female readership. I don't know. And what did he write? He wrote Rabbit, Rabbit Redux. He wrote The Witches of Eastwick. Wouldn't have thought that he has a woman editor, and yet... It would take a very strong personality to stand up to John Updike.
And apparently they say she had it. Yeah.
This woman had it. So
and she was the editor for John Hersey, Elizabeth Bowen, William Maxwell, Camus, Sartre, among others, in addition to some really notable cookbook authors, Madjer Jaffrey, Edna Lewis, Marcella Hassan, Lydia Bastianich, James Beard, Marion right. Cunningham.
Well, they have the Ruth Reichel quote, says there's no cookbook stuff. No. Food books without this woman. Basically.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. But you got to say that her depth of knowledge yeah. and her sort of intelligence yeah. That she brought to the editing of, you know, Camus, Sartre, Updike, etc., informs and made for better cookbooks as
yeah,
well.
Well,
she was the one who, you know, she sees the Julia Child cookbook and knows that it's different. Because actually, it works.
Well, look, it's different things. You know, there are at least three elements to something like that. Number one is you need to have something that, you know, at its core is worthwhile. Two, you need someone to recognize the value of it. But number three, and this goes back to the book that you didn't enjoy, that's not enough. It has to be written correctly. It has to be presented the right way. It has to be edited correctly. And she's doing that also. She's bringing that to life. So it's no small thing.
Yeah, I should also mention she was an editor for M.F.K. Fisher.
Oh, is that right?
Oh, yeah.
I didn't catch that.
One of the greats in terms of food
yeah.
writing.
That's considered the best food writing.
And she, you know, I heard an interview with Judith Jones from a few years ago. Yeah. Beautiful, deep voice. She sounded like just a very interesting person. And supposedly she and her husband were great cooks.
Yeah.
So there's a lot there, just a very interesting, intelligent person who liked to cook.
Yes.
And American.
And American, yes. So there's an article in the paper picking up on football about one of the leading high school prospects in the country, the leading high school quarterback in the country, one of a select few, has signed on to go to Princeton.
Go Tiger, to Tiger, Tiger.
Yeah, and that doesn't happen.
This, boom, 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 bah.
You would normally think he'd go to a real football school. They asked him why he's going to Princeton, an unusual choice, and the quote is, "I want to have a roommate that's smarter than me." Well, there might have been easier ways to get to that point. I suspect that there were many choices available for that. But in any event, he signed on to Princeton. And, you know, it's an interesting thought. I mean, the question is, and the article explores this to some degree, has the world changed? Has the world changed in that you don't have to go to a football factory if you see yourself as a pro football player in the future? Is it now that the scouting is so sophisticated and extensive that, in fact, the pro scouts will find talent wherever it is? That the coaching is sufficiently sophisticated and more to the point that the scholarships available even at non-football ride schools like Princeton are such that, you know, this becomes a viable alternative and it's another way to get to the pros that's unexplored and might be exploited now. So you might see these high-level talents at schools like Princeton or Harvard. And I can tell you pretty easily the answer is no, that this is not going to work out. My guess is I don't know what's going to happen with this kid. I'll assume he's a very good player. The issue, but, you know, I suspect, number one, that he probably has serious reservations about playing in the NFL, which is fine. As far as I'm concerned, that might be the smart way to think about it.
Yeah.
And he might end up in the NFL, but he won't be a first-round draft choice. He would be one of those folks who would be drafted later, and maybe he'll develop into a better player. And I say that because he won't be meeting the level of competition. But more to the point, you have to play at a pro-style offense in college for 4 years and be challenged to really develop. I don't know if Princeton has a pro-style offense. I suppose they have, otherwise he absolutely wouldn't go there. But he's still not going to see anything close to the speed of the game that he's going to see when he gets to the NFL. So he won't be developing at the rate that other folks with whom he's competing will be developing over the next 4 years, which, again, is fine. Fine, as far as I'm concerned.
Well, maybe he'll end up coach, like Jason Garrett.
Exactly right, Jason Garrett, except there's one big difference. Jason Garrett was not a highly recruited kid like this kid. Jason Garrett, if you remember how he got to Princeton, do you remember how?
No,
he,
I do not remember.
His father was the football coach at Columbia, and Jason Garrett was at Columbia, and his father got fired. Oh. And Princeton hired him as assistant, and he said, I'm taking my kids,
two sons,
he had a running back. Uh-huh. And he took his, he said, said to Columbia, I'm taking my two sons with me. And they were much sadder to see the sons go than the father. And they became the two stars of the Princeton team. So we'll see. We'll keep our eye out. The fellow's name is Brevin White. We'll see if he proves me wrong. We'll
What's that first name?
Brevin. B-E-R-V-I-N. Okay. And we'll see if Princeton is in the national championship game 4 years from now. It's
Keep
something to look forward
him.
To.
Okay. You know that Julia Child was an athlete too, right?
No, I didn't. And it shocks me to hear
she
that.
She went to Smith.
Yeah.
And her mother apparently was a big basketball star at Smith. Her mother. And when Julia got there, she was not so successful because they had changed the rules. You know, women's basketball at one point
they used to be stationary.
Yeah, you couldn't move. And Julia couldn't play both ends.
No, I
so she was not a success.
I would expect.
She was a great tennis player, but she was generally a great athlete. Very tall woman.
Very tall.
Caused a lot of...
lateral movement, not a thing.
Excitement in France when she was there because she was one of the tallest people. Anyway, but back to kind of a self-indulgent... topic here.
This is a warning.
On the in the Wall Street Journal, there's an article called titled "Conjuring a Mysterious Sorority," and it's a discussion by MJ Anderson about a painting by John Singer Sargent, "The Daughters of Edward Darley Boyd," and it was painted in 1882. It's a much beloved painting. It's in the Boston Museum of Fine Arts. It's largely pays sort of an homage to the famous Las Meninas.
Ah, oh, yes.
By Velázquez, which is down, you know, in the Prado, of course.
The Prado.
And
right.
So.
Right by the gift shop.
This is interesting to you and me.
Right, both of us.
Because, partly because it's by John Singer Sargent, whose name we brought up a couple weeks ago. Because he was promoted by Henry James. And so he's part of that exhibition at the Morgan Library.
I remember seeing the exhibition at the Morgan Library some years. Now, was it the Morgan?
No. It's at the Morgan
No, but I saw an exhibition in New York that saw John Singer Sargent just a few years ago.
Yes, no, that was somewhere else. But yes, you have.
Okay.
Every few years, you've actually seen more than one exhibition of John Singer Sargent.
I can't get enough of John Singer Sargent.
Okay, but anyway... The Daughters of Edward Darley Boyd.
Yeah.
Okay. So this actually was painted. Edward Darley Boyd was a friend of Sargent's.
Mm-hmm.
They were hanging out in Paris together.
Yeah.
Boyd was married to Mary Louisa Cushing.
Okay.
Okay.
I'm following.
Which is interesting because she's the sister of Olivia Cushing, who's the sister-in-law of Hendrik Christian Andersen.
Oh, my God.
Also mentioned in that exhibition of with Henry James. She financed, Olivia financed a great deal of the his World Center for Communication and the publishing of that and so on and so forth. So the Cushings are a wealthy family in the Boston area with a cottage.
Yeah.
In Newport.
Right.
Okay, that still exists, the Ledges.
Mm-hmm.
And you still see in the New York Times in a couple weeks, you'll probably see pictures of the Cushing estate because they always have the Newport people have some kind of event where they get out horses and carriages and pretend they're in the 19th century or something. So the Cushing's a wealthy Boston family. Money came from shipping to and from the Orient.
Okay.
I've heard rumors of drug trade.
Yeah, okay.
But I can't substantiate that. Okay. Right. Anyway, so we have that. So there's all this wonderful connection. And of course, and it's a nice discussion of this painting. And I enjoyed it. It's not exactly the way I see the painting, but I have sometimes an off way of looking at things. Mm-hmm. MJ Anderson. So actually, that's a name I know. And it says at the bottom here that she's a former member of Providence Journal's editorial board and the author of Portable Prairie, Confessions of an Unsettled Midwesterner. And so, of course, I'm at that age. You know when you get old and you think you just think you know everybody? You know?
No, I haven't gotten that old yet.
Yeah. You know, your parents are always saying, you know, you bring up some person, your parents will say, oh, yeah, he married her.
Yeah.
And they, you know, did that. And I went to high school with that person and so on. And so MJ Anderson, I Google this.
Yeah.
I look on the LinkedIn. Yes, in fact. It's the MJ Anderson. Do you remember MJ Anderson? Dan and I met at Princeton, right, as undergraduates.
Yeah.
We met working in the dining halls.
I just say Commons. Is this
MJ worked for us. Because one of the great things about going to a school like Princeton is the diversity.
Yeah.
Okay. The geographic diversity. I never met anybody from the Midwest. And it's funny that she still trades.
Yeah, I can't conjure up a face,
she's still eating out,
but I remember MJ. Last Sunday in the New York Times, talking the talk back, a session that's held after a play, sometimes scheduled, that the writer, the actors, those associated with the presentation of the play will stay after the play and talk with members of the audience interested in giving their reactions and getting into a discussion about the play.
And they can ask questions.
They can ask questions or they can express their views. The question is a post-play discussion an artist's debt to an audience? And the reason they ask whether it's an artist's debt is because there was one very famous playwright, one we were discussing last week, David Mamet, who is against talkbacks, who is so against talkbacks, but he puts it in his contract with the theater that he will not participate and there will be no talkbacks with respect to his plays. So the Times surveys 6 or 7 other playwrights and asks them each the same list of questions. Do you like talkbacks? What's your best? What's your worst? And do you have thoughts about Mr. Mamet's prohibition of talkbacks? And it's interesting because of the 6 or 7 playwrights they speak to, it's very mixed. You would think that they would all say, oh, I'd love to hear people talk about my play. I'm interested in the audience's reaction. David Mamet may be a little bit extreme. That's not me. That's not what they say. It's very mixed. I'd say it's about very half and half. Some of them absolutely don't like talkbacks.
Mm-hmm.
And they're also mixed about Mamet. Some of them say, look, David Mamet's David Mamet. He can do whatever he wants. He's a top dog.
Right.
And some of them say, one woman, Paula Vogel, who wrote in Decent, goes so far as to say that in her opinion, Mamet's view is like censorship. That she thinks, or another, Will Eno, who wrote Wakey Wakey, says, you know, I think we're supposed to try to cultivate the audience. And this is so interferes with cultivating the audience. So there's some pushback on David Mamet. There's two I'll mention specifically, which I thought they were kind of interesting. Christopher Shin, who wrote a play called Dying City, when asked about Mamet's prohibition against talkbacks, saying, look, Mamet's a very interesting guy. I remember his saying that you know a play is good when people walk out of the theater talking not about the play, but about their lives.
Hmm.
That's the kind of talk back I'd like to see. I think there's something to that. And again, he attributes that quote to Mamet. And then there's sort of a funny exchange at the end with a playwright named Doug Wright, who wrote a play called I Am My Own Wife. And they ask him about his experience with talkbacks, including what was the best one that he ever had. And he said, well, after a preview of I Am My Own Wife, a dashing young man asked a terribly smart question. We've been now together for 15 years and married for 8. And then the question was, do you have thoughts about Mr. Mamet's prohibition? And the answer, yes. If he's single, he should reconsider. So there you go. So that's all we have for this week's podcast. And we'll be back with you next week for
Tamsin and Dan, Read the Paper.
Thanks.